The following podcast is a part of RadioMisfits.com.
Welcome to Misfits Making It. We're oddballs and we're doing cool stuff. I'm your host, Lauren LoGiudice. This is the podcast version of the comedy shows I host around New York City and the road, the Misfit Variety Show, and all the shows at the Capiche Club Misfit Comedy Space down in Little Italy. Well, how's it going? What's up in your Misfit world? This is, very excited to announce, is the last episode of this season. I mean, I guess we sort of have seasons. I don't have like a sort of like a 10-episode season arc, the kind of thing. It's more like flow. And this has been flowing for a bit. I think this is like a year and a half of flow for season three. And we're going to take a few weeks off, and then we're going to jump back into season four in September. What I was able to do is think about, okay, like if I think of this like little mini break, what is going to be next? And we made some small changes, some visual changes. So clips can be a little more like Misfits Making It, you know, a little more of a theme to them visually. We might get a little bit of different music. And I am going to put, I usually always do a question at the end of the podcast with a guest where I had one of my characters. And I think we're just going to be me and Carmella. Carmella is, you know, with me with the Misfit Variety Show, she's always reading audience submitted stories. And so we're going to just have the question be from Carmella every time. And we have a lot more Misfit melodrama coming up next season. I've already recorded. And one thing I think could be helpful for you all Misfits out there, because a lot of us struggle with like multiple passions and scheduling, and how do we like, you know, fit everything in. And this podcast is one of a bunch of projects that I'm doing. I have live shows and I have a movie I'm working on. And how I've figured this out is to batch. So I batch record. I will do a whole bunch of video, like audio recordings, podcast recordings at once. And then I drip it out over like the next 6 months to even a year is how many I could do at once. I've gone a layer beyond that in organization, is that I'm like, all right, I'm going to set aside 4 or 5 Mondays and I'm going to book as many people as I can. I need about like, I know about, like, it's for me as I need about like 3 or 4 hours to like do that research and outreach for that time period. So say like a month before that. So let's say I'm recording them now in August. I set aside like 4 Mondays in August where I'm going to be recording. And I started the research and outreach in early July. And I set aside 3 or 4 hours for that. And then I do as many as I can. And I have a set number I want to reach of podcasts I want to reach. And I try to, I know like if I'm within a range of that number, that's okay. And then the next time that I'm going to do a batch recording is January. And so in between time, I am going to just put like whatever people suggest to me. Oh, you should have this person on your podcast. I'll just put them on a list. And then in that time, when I get to start in January, then in December, when I start to set aside those 3 or 4 hours to do outreach, then I will go to that list and simply like go from there and do the outreach and then set aside only 4 or 5 Mondays and record. And then that's it. So I think for us, like, it's like, you got to just like put boundaries and processes around everything we do in order to like keep it all rolling and just like have faith. Like this is the times I'm going to do it. I know I'm going to get enough. I also do this with on the street videos. When I record social media content, I say like, all right, I'm going to be on the street and for a half an hour, and I'm going to have faith, whatever people come my way are going to be the right people, and it is going to be wonderful, and it'll be enough for what I need to shoot for the day. And you know what? It works out. It absolutely works out. So I think it's like, because you can't let like things swallow your life. Like you can't just have, like sometimes you just sort of resent a project. Like, oh man, I didn't mean for this to like want to take this long. I like kind of like, I love doing it, but I don't want to make it like my whole life. You got to just put like a boundary around it. And I found it to be really helpful. So I hope that is helpful to you, my fellow misfits, multi-passionate misfits out there with a lot of things, million things going on. All right. So before we get to our interview, which I'm very excited about, with Andrea Jones-Roy. A brief reminder, please rate and review the podcast because social proof is super important for Misfits because Misfits trust other Misfits to know what's good. Also, you can sign up for updates at laurenlogie.com. And listen, also, you can sponsor a podcast. We've made it accessible for individuals and small businesses. We put this out about every 2 to 3 weeks, but we put it out more often if we had a sponsor. So go to laurenlogie.com, click on listen and podcast and contact us there. All right. Today, we're having a very special interview. I'm so excited about it. I had coffee with a friend of mine, Jason Farr, who runs There It Is podcast. Shout out to them. And he said, you got to interview my friend, Andrea Jones-Roy. She is a misfit and she's making it and she's doing really cool stuff. And I think you're going to like her. She is a data scientist, a stand-up comedian, and a circus performer. She has an incredibly interesting career, and she's also doing something for the benefit of the world. She really does want to use her skills to help people, which is an absolute beautiful thing. And I feel like the highest form of misfit, in my humble opinion, is someone who uses their misfit powers for good. And in such an intentional way. And we talk a lot about really the nitty gritty of being weird in a world that is hostile to that. And we're even talking specifically about the comedy world, which can be like that as well, which you think, hey, wait a minute, comedy, is it in a bunch of nonconformists out there, banding together to be weird? Yeah, you'd think, not always like that. And you're going to hear more about that from Andrea and I. So let's get to the interview with Andrea Jones-Roy. Welcome, Andrea Jones-Roy, to Misfits Making It.
Thank you. I'm so honored to be a misfit that you think might be making it. Am I allowed to jump to this? I'll see you on the misfits part. I'm there, but we'll let your audience decide who's making what.
I've heard that from people of all levels, and no one ever thinks they're making it. I've concluded.
Wow. Okay. So yeah, I think someone, if they do think they're making it, you're delusional. Maybe none of us think that we're making it. Does Taylor Swift think she's making it? Can we go to Taylor Swift 2 seconds in?
Yeah, she has to. I mean, but she also said something I think she's also aware that it can go away at any moment, or it's not guaranteed to anyone. Yeah. Kind of thing. She's got to work hard to maintain.
Like she's like, oh, I'm making it for now, but who knows if the next tour or the next whatever. Sucks to be Taylor Swift, I think is the headline here. Yeah. Is this what you wanted to talk
who
about?
Who needs that? Who needs it? Yeah, who needs all of that?
Yeah.
Right. So you're a data scientist by trade. Now, I read the book, How to Lie by Statistics, that classic book with it's very short. There's lots of pictures. They lay everything out, a few concepts out pretty clearly. And after that book, I want to ram my head against the wall every time I read something. And this is on all sides. That book's really good at being they're not hey, the Republicans are lying. They're just hey, here's how everyone doesn't understand statistics. Right. And it's true. All walks of life don't get it.
Right.
You have a PhD. Do you just want to, I want to ram my head. You must want to explode every single day.
Yes, for sure. There's the only thing I will add to that is I was not a math person, intrinsically or inherently. I grew up avoiding math and hating math. And I went into a PhD program still thinking I was hating math. And then they were hey, we're doing statistics. And I was oh God, what have I gotten myself into? So this is going to sound patronizing, but I know what it's like to not know statistics. And frankly, the more statistics that you know, just like Taylor Swift, the more you're just oh, I don't understand anything. So if anything, I might have less confidence than say my students after a semester where I'm just oh, I couldn't tell you there's just always more to know, right? Every time you learn something, you learn more about what you don't know. So I do get angry though, because people will say things about numbers that are just not things you can say. And that does upset me. But I'm trying to work on getting people to not say those things. So it's a slog.
It's a slog. Yeah. It's an uphill battle because people just to understand how numbers work, you have to take a minute.
Right. And statistics is something that I'm always telling my students. So I teach undergrad students. I'm always telling them it takes, and this is just based on personal experience, not based on any kind of study. So it's not statistically sound what I'm about to say. I always tell them that it takes about 3 exposures to the exact same statistics concepts, formal exposures. Maybe you could read or self-study on your own, but then you have to set it aside. And then 6 months later, do it again. Or in my case, take a class in undergrad then take a class in grad school. And then for me, it wasn't until I was teaching it that I was like, oh, I see what's going on here. Like, even though I muddled through problem sets and homeworks and whatever, you have to just, there's, I don't know what statisticians are doing. It's just so, it's almost intuitive, but then it's not. Like for me with learning statistics, it was always like, oh, okay, we're rolling dice. We're flipping coins. We've got cards. Pick 1/52, 1/51. Ah. And then the next class, you're just like, I don't know what's going on. And basically the longer you just slog through it, the further you can go before you're like, I don't know what's going on. And it just, it's just so not intuitive. And maybe if I were more of a math person myself, I would be not saying this, but I, none of us understand statistics because it's hard. That's why. I'm like really worked up now. Mm. Is that too much?
It's true, because everyone wants to make it seem like it's easy, right. You know, like, especially when they're saying something that makes zero sense. Right.
And people who really, I like to think, I'm going to flatter myself for a second. I like to think that one of the things that helps me teach this stuff is that because I struggled with it so much myself, I know how it feels to look at, say, a homework assignment or a statistics problem, or even like look at what someone did in a report that I'm reading that I'm interested in from the World Health or whatever, and just be like, I'm sorry, what? Like, I'm frozen. I don't know what to do. Like, I can read each individual number and word and I know what's happening. I just don't, and I'm panicking. And so I've been there so many times that I feel like I can speak to those students in a way that most of the professors that I had in statistics were like math geniuses from day one. And so they waltz in and they say, well, this is so simple and this is so easy. And it's trivial to see that this goes to this, goes to this. And you're just like, none of this is trivial. I don't know what's going on. It's sort of like if you were born reading and never had to learn to read, you're not going to be able to explain how to read to someone who doesn't know how to read.
Right. They're such assholes. I learned calculus from someone. Yeah. I learned calculus from someone just like that. And it's very condescending. Yeah. And it's like, well, I know, understand that this was like easy to you, but other people just need it explained differently, maybe than your mind works. Cause a lot of these people are like, I find also like mental math people, like they're not visual. They just somehow like clicks in their brain, and that's great.
Good
Wonderful.
For you.
Nice for you. Must be nice. But like not everyone's like that.
And there's, and I speak from direct experience in this case, there's a lot of hubris. I'm going to ruin what few friendships I have in my life by saying this. There's a lot of hubris among people who are quote unquote math people, or who find this stuff that comes easy to, very quantitative programming people. Even among my students, the ones and colleagues, the ones who are like math whizzes from the get-go just think they understand everything, and they waltz in and they're like, well, I get it. I can do a model of this and this and this. And it's like, well, no, you don't understand the history of whatever it is that you're studying, the context in which these numbers are operating. You don't really understand how to evaluate the data. And so there's an ego to math people that makes them think that math is like the superior thing. And because you can do that, who needs to learn to like write an essay or be a critical reader or whatever else? And like, you need both. You need
totally. Both. And I'll say, and I'll say this, cause I know you definitely cannot be involved with what I'm about to say, but let's be honest. Okay. A lot of these people were nerds. They were stuffed in a locker, their whole educational background. So when they see someone coming in who isn't exactly like them, who may be a little bit quote unquote cooler or not as whatever, not a nerd like they were, you could be, but you weren't a nerd like they were. They this is their opportunity to get
this
back.
This is where bullies come from, right?
Everyone.
They're just math bullies in a way. You know,
they
this
are.
Is going to be really,
this is your opportunity.
This is going to be really unfair to a lot of very, very nice people who are into math. But frankly, the more I learn about Elon Musk, the more I'm like, you're one of those brats. Like, he's actually, I think, not as good at math and programming as he claims to be, but he does definitely think that because he can program or because he works in tech, he has some like all knowing whatever. And it's like, you more than anyone I've ever met need a sociologist, a psychologist, a historian, a gender study, a whoever, like someone who understands government. Like, you need all those people weighing in at Twitter X way more than you need more programmers. But he just has this ego about him. He obviously has some other problems as well, but he's like the pinnacle of where this can really go wrong, is you think that I'm a tech god and I don't need to listen to anyone from, say, the humanities or something like
and
that.
A lot of these tech people are like that. We're kind of living in Revenge of the Nerds now,
but not like the fun nerds that you're sympathetic to, you know, in like not the Steve Urkels. It's like the brooding nerds.
No, it's like, well, it's like Steve Urkel like never had someone to give him a hug.
Right. Yeah. At least Laura would like bring a blanket when he was on the roof. Is that too much of a deep cut for a Family Matters reference?
I love
very
it.
Specific
deep
reference from that show.
That gets to a horde. Yes. So now you not only stop at data scientists, and your like literal job is to you talk about understanding complexity. So you're just shoving your brain into complex stuff. And then you really try to communicate this. You have so, tell us about all the media projects you have to try to communicate to the
world. Yeah, it's stop and start in the sense that I really enjoy trying to explain this horrible stuff. It's lovely once you get it, but it's very, very difficult. And I feel grateful to have gone through a PhD program. So I'm trying to get the word out in a variety of ways, but then I get in my own way and I say, oh, no one wants to hear this. So I like stop for a while and freak out, but then I'll go back to it. So some of the stuff I'm doing is I have two podcasts. One is called Ask a Political Scientist. My PhD is in political science. And so I went to that program thinking I was going to write essays about like the nature of war and peace and whatever. And then they were like, hey, it's statistics, actually. And so I try to bring a lot of the quantitative research that I am aware of that my colleagues and former classmates are doing to the general audience to say like, hey, we're studying like, when is it actually election fraud? How do we figure out how to motivate people to vote? Like, what is the research behind this kind of thing? And I do a bunch of stuff that's very silly on TikTok, Instagram Reels, because I'm pretending I'm not an elder millennial and am doing that like everybody else. And so I've tried lots of different formats to try to get the good news about thinking quantitatively and how it's not scary. And it really is something that I wish everyone felt comfortable doing. And the people who feel comfortable doing it, I wish they had a bit more humility about it. So I do a lot of those sorts of things. And then we got introduced because of someone I met through a live show that I do sometimes in New York City. I do it over at a place called Caveat, which is kind of like nerdy entertainment, but nerds in the nice way, not the mm-hmm. Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg kind mm-hmm. of way, where I do live shows that are a mix of lecture, comedy, and I'm also a circus performer, so I'll do like trapeze or lyra, which is like aerial hoop. And so I try to combine all the things to make it more fun than just a lecture, I guess. I also really like, honestly, my main passion is keynote animations. I don't know if you've lost days of your life on animating text on keynote slides, but that's like what it boils down to at the end of the day. Like my TikTok is just keynotes. My presentations are just keynotes. And I use the flame animation way too much. I don't know if that's... what you want to hear.
Well, we're going to put a pin in the circus stuff and the comedy stuff. But in general, I want to come back to that. But like, where did this drive to communicate come from? Where does it come from?
Thank you for asking that. It comes from, I think, a gratitude that I got to learn this stuff that I for sure would not have learned. So unlike everyone I work with, not everyone, most people in my academic data science world. As I said, I did not grow up as a math person. I was not drawn to quantitative anything. In college, I went out of my way to not take a math class or a science class, except for some essay course called Physics of the New Millennium or something that was just garbage. And also that's how old mm-hmm. I am. And we just read the New York Times and science section and wrote essays. Like I was not a science person and I would not have gone into the sciences. And because I didn't know what political science was, I went into this program. I don't know how I got in. And they basically force fed me for years and years and years, really technical statistical methods. And I hated it and I hated it and I hated it. And I almost dropped out a million times. And then once I got through, I was just stubborn and I had such low self-esteem that I was like, I can't drop out because then I'll be thinking I'm stupid for the rest of my life. I still think I'm stupid, but I was like, I can't drop out. I'll never get over it. And so it eventually clicked one day, not like, oh, I understand math, but just like, oh, I see why we're doing this. I understand the beauty of turning really complicated, complex, nuanced social, I study social phenomena with data science, turning that stuff into numbers, looking at it really carefully. And then the part that you're referring to at the open of the conversation, translating it in some kind of honest way back to the world. And so I was like, this is awesome. Everyone should get to learn this. Cause I felt like I just walked like Alice in Wonderland. Like I had no business. I never would have ended up. If someone said, do you want to do a PhD in data science? I would have been like, no fucking way. No way. So I was like tricked into it by virtue of not reading the program description. And so by the end of it, I was like, this is incredible. Who's in charge of making sure that everyone else knows this? Not just those of us
Nobody.
I actually thought that public policy, there was a public policy, University of Michigan. There's a public policy program that was a master's program, a PhD program. I don't know what they study in public policy. The entire time I was in my PhD program in political science, I was thinking, oh, the public policy people study our work and then they use it to make policy. And then I found out that that's not what they do. They do their own work and they have nothing to do with us. And so yet again, here we are, you know, it's too much of the sciences are just us talking to each other. And it just drove me nuts.
Right, right. So, I mean, like for me, like what drives me to share my story, like learn to communicate better, like learn to perform better, long to like share my story is that like I grew up around people who, you know, made me feel bad about being different. And I really want to be able to reach other people to feel better about being different, you know, just that it's okay. You can live your, be who you are, like, and that is a beautiful thing unto itself. So that, and it's sort of like a way for me to like help this self, like my younger self retroactively. Like, so that's what drives me. And I'm wondering if there's any sort of like nugget of like, other than like seeing these people who are, and I hear this from academics all the time. It's just like, they just talk to each other. They're super like, and also the academia sort of like lends itself to making it hard for academics to share, where it's like poo-pooed on. You know, they like you almost like if you're going to go for tenure, like you're, it's almost better to be a shitty professor who only talks to other academics than to be a great professor who like reaches the lives of students and shares with the world all the
stuff. You've talked to a lot of professors, I see. That's exactly right. It's the system is so fucked. I don't know how much I can swear on this show, but I've already done it a million times. It's
swear away. We swear.
There we go. All the way. No, the incentives are all wrong. There's, you know, there really is no, it's changing a little bit since when I was in grad school, but generally speaking, you don't get any, it used to be an active negative thing. If like you had a research paper that like got some traction on Twitter, now it is like maybe neutral. Best case scenario. Usually, unless your research is also really, really, really unusually fantastic, so decree the powers that be in academia. Any time you spend on outreach or communication or focusing on teaching at the expense of research is, you might as well just say, like, I'm not going to get tenure. I'm not going to succeed in this field. It's just very perverse and very egotistical and very, very difficult. I don't know if I mentioned this before we started recording, but so I've left academia. This is my first semester not teaching at NYU, and I'm going to go full on the media outreach thing because I just got sick of it. So if I sound negative, I am.
Right. So funny. I know another person who quit academia, similar reasoning. She just couldn't stand it anymore. She just felt like, the way this is set up is not the way like the world's going to change. And I can't really be.
No. And
of
I
this.
Even thought, you know, I teach or used to teach, these big lecture courses. It was a course called Data Science for Everyone. I taught it many, many semesters, very, very proud of it. The idea was to reach out to students who are like trying to be artists and poets and historians and say like, here's how to have the quantitative skills you're going to need to participate in the world and contribute to the world if you want to, right? Blah, blah, blah. But the only students who were showing up were these like computer science, engineering, math students. So I wasn't even reaching the students I wanted to reach. The students I was teaching were perfectly nice, but I was like, they don't need me. They are the ones who can listen to the people who spoke math from the day they were born. So I'm not contributing.
So
I'm doing this and I'm not really reaching the people that I want. And the world is crumbling all around us. And like, I'm not going to pretend that I'm here to save anything, but like you started the conversation, I look around and I see the way that we think, what we think numbers can do and what data can say or not say, it can't say anything. And the way it's misused, I was like, surely I can be more useful there than arguing with 18-year-olds about a point they got wrong on the homework. Hypothetically.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you could have called it like data science for not scientists, data science for weirdos, but they're like, they're not going to do it.
If anything, calling it data science for everyone, we got a lot of pushback from the like dean or provost. Someone high up was like, I don't know if you should call it that because it's going to sound like it's too easy. It sounds like it's an easy course if you say it's for everyone. You're like, what are you? You just think the masses are by default stupid. Like that's the attitude we're working with. And then one of the other reasons I left is I went to the department I was in, super nice, Center for Data Science at NYU. Everyone was lovely. But I went for several years and tried to find a different sort of role where I was like, I like what I'm teaching, but I'm not quite reaching the students I want to reach. Like, what if I did something that was more like data science for artists and so on? And they were just like, even though a handful were very, very sympathetic, there was no interest. There was no one wanted to put resources towards it. And they were like, no, we need you to keep teaching the computer scientists. And I was like, they don't need me. Yeah.
Wow. So was this drive to communicate all from the experience in academia, or is there like a personal reason?
Well, I think what you said really resonates about your own desire to kind of talk through or help other people see that it's okay to feel like you're not the same or you're a misfit is I just remember being so miserable and frightened and down on myself anytime I did math and science growing up. And, you know, I mostly reach out to other adults as opposed to children. I just don't have a very child-oriented personality, but I just feel like I always was really quite paralyzed and like found all that stuff really scary and then thought, what's wrong with me? Why am I so stupid? Why can't I do this? And then I would just be like, I'm not even going to touch it. And I see too much of that in my own life. Like I go to comedy and comedians will say, oh, data science. Oh, I could never do that. I don't want to touch that. And it's like, you totally can. There's nothing magical or special about this. Just like, you know, a nerdy person could do comedy. A lot of nerdy people do comedy. Like, we've just put science on this pedestal, and I did too. And it is amazing, but it's not untouchable. And so I think a lot of the communication, you know, what you said, like, I might be just trying to talk to my younger self. That's like, you don't have to be scared of this. Like, there's no reason. It's no different from learning Spanish or French or chess. You just, it's going to be hard, and you practice and you make mistakes and then you go. It's not unusual compared to all these other things. So there's that piece of it. The other piece of it is I really do get stressed out that the world is crumbling. And I think that if more people who cared about the world felt comfortable using quantitative tools, we'd be better off. Whereas like a lot of people I know who do a lot of really amazing social justice work think that data science is not relevant to them. But it's like, if you could inform these algorithms that are tearing up our lives, that would make a huge difference. So like kind of just connecting those worlds as well. But yeah, no, I'm probably just trying to make myself feel better in the past.
There you go. Where did circus, because circus performing came first and then comedy, is that right?
Kind of. I did improv comedy first, then circus, then stand-up. But I did improv originally because I was too afraid to do stand-up, and I was terrible at improv, just dreadful. I knew that I was terrible because a friend of mine who's an actor asked me once, she was like, what kind of characters do you do when you're on stage? And I was like, oh, I do like standing still, arms crossed, my own personality. And she was like, So I really was meant to do stand up. But so I did improv and that was very fun. But I always did dance growing up and movement and things like that. And I went to grad school thinking I was a dance minor in college. Thank you so much. Hold your. Very useful. A lot of my data science students be like, what should I minor in? If I don't minor in computer science, I'm never going to get a job. And you're like, chill out, man. I minored in dance. And then they immediately don't listen to anything else I say for the rest of the semester. But I got back into movement in grad school just to stay sane. I literally would leave statistics class and go to like a ballet class at the musical theater department at Michigan. I joined the University of Michigan synchronized swimming team for 2 years until they were like, this is for undergrads. You have to go. Okay. I did a lot of yoga. I did some figure skating until I saw a video of myself skating. I was like, I'm horrible at this. And I was deep in my dissertation phase, which is when you write your big project all by yourself. And I just later was diagnosed with ADHD. I also have like depression, anxiety, imposter syndrome. So I was getting nothing done. I was miserable. I was alone for like a year in Michigan. And I saw a flyer at the grocery store for something called the Detroit Fly House, which was an aerial like warehouse for studying like aerial silks and trapeze and things like that. And I was like, what is this? I must go. And so I like got in my car and drove there. It was like an hour and a half and walked in and all these people were like swinging from stuff and doing flips and whatever. And I was like, I didn't know adults were allowed to do this. I was probably 25 at the time. And I was like, this is amazing. And so I went every week during grad school. And the best part was no one asked me about my dissertation. No one gave a shit about academia. It was like the only time I was away from academics. It was so good for me. And so I just got more and more into it and then started performing and started performing a lot. I got very obsessed. And then this is kind of a long winding story, but the one final point of inflection is I moved to Shanghai in 2013 to work at NYU's campus out there. I studied Chinese politics. And so they took me out there to work. And I went there mostly to quit circus because I was like, this is too much of a distraction. I've got to stop going back to Detroit. I was going to New York and I was training. And then I got there and a month in of my like leaving circus behind forever, I was like 30 at this point, a circus themed nightclub opened in like the big downtown like nightclub area. And I was like, well, obviously I'm going to go to that. And so then I went and then I liked it. And then I auditioned and I became a full-time performer there. So I was like a professor during the day, circus performer at night. And so it was like went from like student to like, oh, I could do this for a living. And I never fully did only circus, but there were long stretches of my life where it was like my main income after that. And it was awesome. It rehabilitated me completely because I had such low self-esteem after grad school. Like I was very, very broken because I just felt so down on myself and I had been so isolated for so long. And I had been so around academics that you don't, you forget that it's not the whole world. Because I just went straight from undergrad to grad school, from grad school to a postdoc, from a postdoc to a faculty. And so I was just like never not in the university system. And this was my first job outside of it. And it was like wild and weird. And I learned like eating fire. And my best friend was a sword swallower. And we like jumped through hoops and we had all these. And it was so fun and it was so wild. And I just finally felt like I was like alive again. And so circus is like my main, I mean, everyone, you know, maybe if you're a long distance runner, you're a rock climber, we all have our things that kind of help keep us sane. And mine is circus. For sure. I would be absolutely dead if I didn't have it.
I mean, absolutely. And like, the thing is like minoring in dance, like you were just becoming more of a well-rounded human.
Thank you very much.
Like, we don't have to like, we need to become like to solve problems that you're talking about. Like we need to be like, our mind needs to expand in different directions. And then like Steve Jobs himself, the like tech person that everyone looks up to, he had like his course in calligraphy was instrumental to designing iPhones.
I was literally thinking about exactly that example the other day and his like, the dots connect themselves. I remember reading that and it was just like, I mean, it was a very well regarded speech generally. It's not like I saw something special, but it really helped me feel better. I actually wrote most of my last draft of my dissertation on the night that he died. Is that a fun fact? I don't know. Yeah, I was in this. I was in Pittsburgh. I was at Carnegie Mellon for a postdoc, and I had like 2 weeks to finish my degree, or I would like lose my job and blah blah blah. And so I was like pounding this thing. I pulled an all nighter. I was like drinking coffee, eating Thai food, and then all of a sudden, everyone's screens just went to like Steve Jobs' picture because we're all on Apple computers. And I was like, "What? Why?" And I was like, "Oh my God, he just died." And then I worked for another 6 hours. So I'm glad you mentioned him because it was a weird. It was a weird time, but you're right. And when I was growing up, I feel like I was always told like, yeah, be well-rounded. That's how you're going to get into college and you want a sport and you want to volunteer and you want to do this and you want to do that. But I don't see that anymore. And that was one of my other frustrations with higher education is like, I don't know if it's the students I was working with, if it's something about NYU, students who go to college in New York, even people in New York, it's like, if you're not all in on something, you're seen as like a dilettante and like not serious. And so my students would be like, I couldn't possibly study something other than data science. Or like I talk to comedians and they say, if you do anything other than comedy, like you're not serious about comedy. And I just feel like I'm so glad you're doing the work that you're doing because life is about, and one of the cool things about being human is we can do lots of different stuff.
Right. And that's not how art works. It's just like, this is not how it works. And like that's back in the day. I mean, scientists were like artists.
Yes. They absolutely were.
It was all
the same.
It was Leonardo da Vinci. Yeah. Like, was it science and art and that's, and there's connections. And it's like, when we try to just silo ourselves, we lose out on so much. And that's when everything becomes derivative and people are thinking the same.
I mean, even within fields, it's considered bizarre to be like, oh, do you do, and this is maybe just like a New York City comedy world phenomenon, but it's like, oh, are you doing stand up or are you doing improv? Like how many people do both? Very few, because you're seen as like not dedicated. So it's not like, oh, I'm doing comedy and music or comedy and like being a pre-K teacher. It's like, you're doing two different kinds of comedy. Well, they're not serious. Like we're so siloed that we're making new silos within the silos. It's depressing.
Yeah, I think totally. Totally. It is depressing. And the thing is like, what, all of the cool stuff that like has broken through or been interesting is never in the, it's not in the silo. Because in order to think of something outside the box, you cannot be in the box.
Yeah.
That's a tweetable. That's a tweetable.
I'm going to quote you on that. That's good. Yeah.
Yes. And then when did the stand-up, when did you start doing
stand-up? So I started doing stand-up in Shanghai as well. Everyone, I did the typical, like, I'm in my 30s, I'm having a crisis, let me live in Asia and find myself. Like, I really didn't mean to, and I did go there for, like, a serious job. That's my own bias, right? Serious job. But I did go there not to find myself. But after the circus that I was working for closed, I had been doing some improv in Shanghai, and there the improv and stand-up worlds were more mixed together because it was a really small comedy scene. It was a mix of international people mm-hmm. and local Chinese. And we did shows in English. We did shows in Chinese. And it was all very fun. And so one night I was talking to my improv teammates, a handful of whom did stand up, and I was like drunk. And I was like, what I've always wanted to do my entire life is stand up. That's all I've ever really wanted. I'm just too afraid, blah, 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 blah. And so I was lucky that they were like, fuck that, you're going to do the open mic next week. And so it was peer pressure that got me to finally like show up, or like not peer pressure, but having someone encourage me to do it as opposed to like just show up was very helpful. Cause I used to go to like open mics. I was such a creep. I would go to open mics in New York City before that and just watch. Who watches a New York City open mic? And I was like too afraid to go up. So it was just someone being like, yeah, come on in, like helped me get over my thing. And so then I did it there a whole bunch. And then I, you know, really started doing a lot more of it when I got to New York. But it's, I had always, always, always wanted to do it. And I was just too fucking afraid. I was too afraid of bombing. Mm. I was too afraid of like saying something that I thought was like, I was like saying something that I think is funny and that people know I prepared thinking it was funny and having them not laugh at me must be the worst thing ever. And so because of that fear, I just didn't fucking do it. And it's like, how many other things am I not doing because of that fear? And so I wish I could say I had some brave moment. It was like, I literally had to move across the world, stay there for 2 years, and then have a friend peer pressure me into it. And frankly, the only reason I finally showed up on stage is I was like, if this goes so badly, I can move back to the United States and no one has to know that I did it. Like, it was the most cowardly version of stand-up comedy you could ever do.
Well, also, to be fair to you, is that I took me a long time to do stand-up because I would go into comedy clubs and there was this like cishet white dudes on stage making everyone feel bad, which is the opposite of what I want to do when I'm on stage. Like, I don't want to make people, I want to make people feel light and happy and open. And I was like, oh, this isn't for me.
Yeah. And was it, did you start in?
And so you have to like go.
Did you start in New York?
I did start in New York. And an older comedian was like, hide, develop and hide. So I would like go to like the middle of nowhere and do open mics. Then I sort of was like, I was like kind of developing my voice a bit. And then I started doing stand-up as Melania Trump. And then unfortunately really started to hit the ground in New York and went to a lot of these terrible open mics. They hated me mostly because I was doing something different. And it took the pandemic for me to recover. I felt like I had PTSD.
Wow. I'm so sorry.
And it was like, you know, you just started to doubt yourself and then I developed a lot of hacks and I took a hacky habit and I took a class with Caroline Castiglia. And a friend of mine, she was like, take my class. I'll kind of help you get out of this. Cause I was just like doing stand up as myself again. And it was just like not working. And she brought me in and just like, if I had to sit down for like a year and a half, I couldn't even do stand up sitting up. Just to like get, and then clown helped me. It's like a huge process to get myself out of the damage that negative environments do to
you. I mean, what you're describing sounds exactly like what I was saying about academia. It's like you get into these environments that are so like self-contained and like self-important and filled with egos and filled with cishet white men who think that they're God's gift to whoever. And if you don't conform with that, or you don't think that way, or you show up on stage in a different way, you're going to be rejected. And it's just, it's so culty. It's like high school cliques, but worse. And you leave high school and you think that stuff's over and it's like, oh, it's only just beginning. I'm so sorry that you went through it. Did you say you went to clown school? Like,
well, yeah, I've been to clown, not circus clown, but like Philippe Gollier clown.
Oh, that's impressive. Style. That's serious. I've never done it, but it sounds, I have friends who swear by it. It's like really intense, right?
I swear by it. Yeah, because they point out your flaws pretty intensely. But the main thing is, and I totally hear you and vibe with you with this, like, you know, feeling like you're awful, feeling like you're terrible. It's always awful. Everything you do is awful. Like, they're like, this is where you fall short today. But it doesn't mean forever. And the Groundlings, I did a lot of stuff on like over the pandemic on Groundlings on Zoom. And they're the same way. They're very honest. And it's like, today you're not doing it right.
Oh, I like that.
But tomorrow?
I like that so much. You've said so many things I'm going to like write down. I have visions. I'm just going to start writing on my wall. I just forget it. That's awesome. Yeah. No, the first time I did comedy, so I did comedy in Shanghai for about a year, and I was very lucky. I've told many people who I know now who are starting out in New York City's stand up that, like, if I had started here, I don't know that I would have continued, because the open mic scene is so bro-y and so toxic, and it just makes you feel bad. Mm-hmm. My very first open mic in New York City, I went in, it was at the Creek in the Cave in 2015. And I go in, and it was like one of those 3 minute mics or 3 minute open mics. And I went in and I watched a bunch of dudes do their thing. And then I went up, and my material was all about, like, I'm a professor and I'm a circus performer and I live in Shanghai and these are the things about my life. And I did material that's like nothing great. It wasn't particularly funny, but it wasn't like offensive to anybody, or so I thought. Turns out I got off stage and all these dudes were just like, who the fuck do you think you are, like, walking in and being like from an international place and having a job? And like every other dude was talking about, like, well, I'm single again, I live with my parents, I'm jerking off, like all the white dude stand-up comedy bingo. And it's like, how is it that they're making me feel bad about myself? I mean, my life was a wreck too. I was living in China, not because I was successful, because I was like having a breakdown, but like the fact that I felt bad compared to these dudes who were just like, I've been single for 1,000 years and I like have 800 roommates. I was like, I need to be more like you. Like, how twisted is that?
Right. Yeah. In your head. It's so twisted. And even though I was like very conscious of it, like, oh, I know that these people are awful, I know that they're limiting and own their own, and they're in the box of their own making, I still was getting affected. And that just, like, now I'm really careful about the environments I'm in and like where I'm in. And like, I'd rather just like work out material, like with friends or some other way than like,
I haven't been to an open mic. It's not worth it. New York City. It's too much.
It doesn't really help. It actually, Caroline Casigula had, when I first started, she was like, don't go to an open mic.
Nice. Yeah.
Don't. She's like, because women and BIPOC people should not be going. Cause like they're going to try to filter you out. In their own little fucking way.
And if I, as like white cis presenting person, am feeling left out, like, imagine someone with less privilege trying to like navigate these horrible rooms. No, it's rough. Yeah.
Yeah. And you find it even in like Brooklyn's supposed to be better, but I find it in Brooklyn too, you know, it's super bro-y, and it just like, you know, and I find even the dudes don't like it. They're like, oh, no, it's awful. It's all dudes. Yeah. So they know it's awful too. They're like, oh, we're together. Yeah. I know. Man, you have to figure it out.
I feel bad for them, really. They're, I mean, I do, actually. I'm not worried, but I do feel bad for cishet men, but I'm not going to, like, you know, work on improving their lives. I'll leave it to them. I also find that if I'm around those groups, and even performing at particular clubs around the city, if I'm at the same ones over and over and I know the other people on the lineup, it's like, I notice myself, like, I start to try to just make the other comics laugh, and it's mostly cishet men in the back of the room. And so I change my material because I'm trying to like be funny in the context of a Brooklyn open mic. And it's like, that's not going to be funny to most of the people in the world. It's a very, very small population. Mm-hmm. Certainly, it's not even going to be funny in New Jersey or like Yonkers, right? And I know that because I've tried and have done poorly in those other places, because you just get so stuck in your own little bubble. And like you said earlier, it just makes for worse art at the end of the day, because we're all just like, tunnel visioning ourselves into the same point. And who was it, not to get on a soapbox about this, but it was all cishet white men who got really wound up about Hannah Gadsby and like, it's not comedy and it's not this. And it's like, it was just every bro I've ever met in an open mic was like, that's not really comedy. And you're like, it's the most like visionary comedy I have seen maybe ever. So
I saw it live and I was like, I didn't know what was happening, because I saw it in the beginning.
I didn't know what I was in for. Did you see it at Soho Playhouse, or were you in LA? Yeah, me too.
Uh-huh, in Soho Playhouse. And I was like watching it unfold, and it was just like, oh, she like turns at a certain point. You're like, oh, wow.
I went because a friend of mine, I was like, maybe we were there on the same night. It had a huge run. I'm sure it was a little bit. But I went with a friend of mine. We had like second row seats. She was from Australia, my friend. And she was like, oh, I love this comic. You're a comedian, like, you come. And I was like, okay. And she started and I was like, yeah, pretty fun. Like, oh, it's kind of cute. And then I left just being like, I have to see it again. I have to see it 100. I went to my boyfriend. I was like, you have to see this so that we can continue to have a relationship. Like, it has to.
Yeah, totally. Amazing. I texted like 3 friends afterwards and I was like, you have to see this right now.
And then the second time I went, I brought my boyfriend, like Emma Thompson was there. Like all these famous people were there. Whereas the first time I went, it was all just people who looked like me. Like we're all, yeah, rolling in from.
Yeah, there were famous people. I went a second time as well. Same. I went after like, yeah. And it was like, wait a minute.
Yeah, I was like, this is a different crowd. Yeah, it was like, these people just came from spending more on dinner than I pay in rent. But okay, yeah.
I was actually, I met her after the show because of, I was going to interview her. And,
for this show? For this podcast?
For magazine. For Curve magazine. Okay. I was going to do a feature of her. And then the... I met her after she was like, yeah, I have this Netflix special coming out and I haven't really wrapped my head around what's going to happen. And it was wild. And then, her publicist, basically she changed the publicist, got a bigger one. And that's what happens. They like, once they get huge, the smaller fry stuff and especially the gay stuff, they don't want to talk to anymore. Yeah. Happens. Even if they don't. Even if I don't even think Hannah knew that was happening, because afterward, like before I left, Hannah was like, make sure we get an interview after we met. But I think, you know, it's just out of your hands.
The forces that be. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
What is she like to talk to?
So then how do you,
was she nice?
Oh, what was she like to talk to? She was fun. She was, I mean, she had just come off stage and it was definitely an emotional piece for her. And she was felt, I had my friend with me, comedian Mick Diflo. And he's very dry. And he was like, he looked at her and he went, that looks exhausting.
Yeah, it does.
She was lovely. And we randomly like know someone from Australia and we both took a comedy class, but just so randomly, like we had ran. So she's lovely.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Oh, amazing. Yeah. No, she's a hero of mine. And just, the mainstream, whatever, all got up in arms because perish forbid someone's different from the rest of us. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Although like, you know, people like Marc Maron were like, that was great. You know, there's some people who cishet women too, who were like, no, although I don't know. He's not usual. He's weird too. You know, Marc Maron. So he's weird too. So now how do you interact with the comedy scene in New York now? Like what's your, are you working at clubs now?
Medium. I'm at the Grizzly Pear, which has two locations. So I like to say plural. I'm at clubs, but that's the only one that I'm like regularly at. I'll do New York Comedy Club every now and again and like stand up New York, whatever on a sort of random basis. This month I am, grounding myself, from comedy because I'm trying to write a book, and it's been going horribly for 2 whole years. And so I was like, this isn't working. I need to focus. And so I'm not allowed to go back to comedy until I finish this like particular draft. It's just a proposal. It's not like the actual book. And it's been killing me to not go on stage, but usually I'm at the Pear like a handful of nights a week. And occasionally do shows like around the region, but I'm not like, it's been difficult, and I'm curious to hear your philosophy on this because I feel like it will make me feel better. But it's been a difficult journey to get to a point where I was like, oh, I really love doing stand-up. I find it very cathartic in a special kind of way. I like, even though I've just said all these nasty things, I like many comedians, and I like the scene of like being in clubs with comedian friends. Like it's like satisfies that we're all just a little bit off, and I like that. It's and as you know, but I had it really struggled. I was kind of during the pandemic and since where I was just like, okay, is my goal to be like Nate Bargatze or like to have a Netflix special and do The Path and like be on Late Night and blah blah. And first of all, Netflix Late Night, if you're listening, yes, I'm available and I'll do it. But I need to accept the fact that I'm not 100% interested in comedy, and so I think that my ultimate performance form is going to be. I think of comedy as like the ballet of performing, whereas it's like, it keeps me sharp. It's regular time on stage, like the crowd work stuff. I really enjoy. But what I'm trying to do with my like science communication, like it informs that, but because we're around people who are like all in on stand-up, it's been very difficult for me to say like, okay, I'm just not putting in the time to get to the like, to be, when I got here, I was like, I'm going to be at the Cellar. I'm going to do this. And I was just like, I would love to be at the Cellar, but I have to accept that if I want to also do other things, unless they want a weird offbeat, whatever comedian, like I need to be okay with the fact that my goals are not 100% the same as the person next to me who's trying to go the straight and narrow stand up only path.
Right. And they're going to have different things come from it. Like they're not going to have the opportunities you're going to have.
That's true. I hadn't thought of that. But even as I'm saying it, I'm like, maybe you get success by not. It's like, I literally can't go out every night because I have like other things that I'm working on and I'm unwilling to give those things up. And so I was like, I have to be okay with the fact that I'm not going to reach the Olympics of comedy.
Right. And then maybe like the thing is comedy is just useful for you in a different way. And so like, maybe you're just like not going to do the Cellar, but like, or maybe you will. Cause listen, if you get famous,
I was like, maybe there's just like, and this like, I bet, you know, I'd love to hear like the Misfits philosophy on this, but I was like, maybe this is just like an alternate way. Best case scenario, I do my own weird thing and then the seller notices me, because I think my regular comedy is never going to be good enough to be at the seller. But they're also not asking Hannah Gatsby to be at the seller, or maybe they are and she's saying no because they book people that presumably she disagrees with.
Maybe. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I think it's just, it's so hard, because the thing is that now everything's like the Wild West. So there's no hard and fast anything. And the people who are booking tours are like huge on TikTok or just huge. And I mean, so like, it doesn't really matter, I guess. Like, I, you know, the way I see it, like, I am not necessarily like trying to get into a club. Although, like, if I just did an audition for someone and, you know, it was more for me to get a tape. I was like, I need a tape so I can get on more shows. But like, I'm not necessarily like, because I can't, what am I going to do? Like, subsume my life into making some booker happy? Like, that sounds like a sad life. Same. Like, I'm not doing that. And a lot of the people that are, I know, who are like subsuming their life to get that goal, they seem like they have PTSD, the women. They seem damaged emotionally. Yes. And this is not everyone, but a lot of them. And maybe it's, I'm just, maybe it's confirmation bias, because I feel like it's going to do that. So I'm signaling out like the people who I feel like have that. But I don't know. I just, you know, for me, I just like want to keep performing and getting on stage as much as I can. I make my own shows. I make my own things. And to showcase the best of what I can do. And I just want to like be around other people who are really funny and doing cool things and perform. And I don't know, I guess I should, some people are like, oh, I have to have a Netflix special. I have to have that. And I think, I can't control those things. Those are super out of my control.
No, I think that's all very helpful to hear. Cause I think that's I agree. I mean, I feel the same way as you're describing, which is like, I love the stage time. And this experiment, this month off, has been in part because, apart from the pandemic, I've never not done comedy while living in New York. And I've been in New York for like 7 years. And so I was like, let me just see. I was like, am I just doing this because I'm used to it? Am I just doing it cause I think I should? And I'm only, It's 11 days into my month of no comedy, and I already cheated once to do a show upstate, and it was very fun. And now I'm just like, I feel like not quite myself. Like, I like the adrenaline of being on stage. I like working out, you know, for all the stuff we've said about the cishet white dudes. Like, there are a lot of really awesome people in comedy, and I really enjoy going. And those of us who've survived, and you're right, many have PTSD from all this kind of like sucking up to whoever, right? Who's some horrible booker or some bar owner or some something. It is interesting people up to weird, cool stuff who haven't chosen, you know, mainstream paths in life. And so I find a lot of similarities to the circus, which is what was so helpful for me about the circus. Was I was just so told that there was one way to live, and this particular way was like academia and high achievement. And then I met all my circus friends, and they were just like, oh yeah, I was in school for like a week and said fuck this and moved to Germany. You're like, oh, awesome. Like, and now I make a living doing this and this and this. And they're just and comedians have that same edge to them, a lot of them. Like, we're just a little bit, we don't fit in, and because of that, it makes us better artists. But I like being around those people, and so I miss it. I'm 11 days in, but I miss it dearly. But it is hard. It is hard to say, okay, I'm around all these people who have this particular goal. It's very difficult for me, at least, to say it's okay to not have the same goal as them. That's been very hard.
I hear you. And to me, like, cause I'm saying that now, but like, then I'm surrounded by people who, like, actually going to see someone nameless, for a thing on a nameless day for a nameless thing, who I know is going to start putting me down this rabbit hole. Cause he has a certain philosophy of how comedy is done. And I'm like, how am I going to deal with this? Cause I know I think I'm going to deal with it by not talking to him.
That might be the way. That's,
because I just can't deal with him and his like way of comedy. And then I'm like, oh, but I look at you and you're a miserable fuck. I don't want to be you.
Yeah.
So who cares?
Yeah.
You know, what can you do? I mean, I can't like, you know, I just can't. It's just so hard. And I feel like more and more, I just need to like silo myself and not be in a silo, but protect boundaries myself style. From the negative.
Yeah. No. And I think that like, I'm curious if this is connected to the misfit nature. Is like, it sucks that, you know, my instinct is I'm so easily persuaded by the enthusiasm of others. So if I meet someone who's in comedy who early on is nice to me and is like, well, this is what you need to be doing, and this is what you need to do. And I was like, okay, this is what I will do. And then I'd go to like a mentor in academia and they're like, well, this is even this and this. And I was like, okay. Like, I just am so quick to like do like, yes, sir, how high? They're always dudes. to whoever it is that I've like decided I need to emulate in some other world. And it really has only been, and I'm saying this as though I like have figured it out. I haven't really, I'm working through it, but it really has only been very recently that I was like, oh, I don't need to listen to any of these fuckers. Like they have been helpful. Different people have been helpful in different stages. And I was very lost in comedy and I was very lost in academia, but it's like, I'm too quick to say like, what do you think my goals should be, random person? And then you just do that without even thinking about it. And then I wonder why I'm miserable.
Well, it's hard because too, there's no roadmap. Right. And so it's like when someone is so certain, it's so easy to follow along with them because they're so confident and certain in their philosophy. Yeah. And then you're just like, oh, yeah, maybe I should do that.
You are right though about comedy in particular is that like the rug is being pulled out from under us as far as like what it takes to be successful. Like I think the way that TikTok in the last couple of years and Reels and all that stuff has changed the game. It's like, I see so many people on shows who have huge TikTok followings and are like medium at stand-up. And so it's just like all the things that all those dudes were telling me that I needed to do to like go hang out at New York Comedy Club all night long and get to know the booker and and suck up to these people. It's like, should I be doing that? Like I was barking for a long time and I was like standing out there in the snow and I was like, why am I doing this? Like I should go home and make reels and then I'll get more stage time anyway. What? And so it's changing in real time. Whereas,
and they're so mad.
They're so mad. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. My problem with Reels is the same in TikTok. Are you doing the clips in the social media?
I do clips. I mean, for stand-up, I'm just trying to figure it out because I just have, it's hard to find a clip that makes sense while scrolling beginning, middle, and end. And the sound and the lighting look good too because I have had so many tech glitches, you know?
I don't know how these comics are getting such good tapes. Comics that I'm performing with who like you look at their clips and you're like, it looks like you hired a camera crew. And I know you didn't because I was there, but like, my picture is grainy. My voice is going in and out. And then they are like, did you set up four microphones, two angles for this like 6 p.m. Saturday show? I can't believe it. So I don't know. My cinematography skills are lacking.
Yeah.
But I'm also being held back by the same thing that held me back from stand-up, which is like, someone's going to say something mean to me. Oh, I'm going to. And it's like, A, everyone says mean stuff to everyone on the internet and it sucks and it's shitty and you should be okay with it. But B, like, why am I letting some random stranger like dictate? Like, how low is my self-esteem that I can't handle a negative comment? Like, that's.
Well, as a data person, you know, you should know that like a lot of the people too, I'd say whenever I've had like, I've made the mistake of replying to a troll, it sets off the troll bots. And so most of the people who are hating are probably not even really people. There's bots somewhere. So I'd say like when I go into their profiles, I see like 90% of them are not actual people. So you can't even take it seriously because you don't know. I mean, I just saw Carmen Lynch, one of her her stand-up clips, like, oh my God, the hate she was getting. And I commented like, oh, that all the haters are men or is telling. But I don't know if a lot of those people were even real people. I think some of them are, but I think a lot of them But you know, but just like, what are you going to just fuck it?
Well,
cares,
that's the thing is like, what am and it's like when I do a show and if people don't like it, fine. They just like tend not to tell me. Sometimes they will. Don't come and tell me. But like, there's something about seeing it in writing that I was just like, I was like, I can't handle it. I don't know. It's, I'm like ashamed of that. I'm so bothered by it. And I think it's like the ongoing saga of low self-esteem, but it's just.
Well, although, you know, I will say I went on your TikTok and I noticed, I looked in the comment thread. I was just wondering, because, you know, comment bots, how they work. Because you're doing political science work, PhD work. There's a lot of anti-academia going, fervor going on. And, oh my God, so many nice comments.
Okay, as you were saying that, I was like, what's in it? I haven't looked in a while.
Wonderful. Okay. Like, thank you, spot on, amazing. I feel the same way. So you have a lot of fans, which means that when the trolls come, they're going to go to town for you.
Yeah.
So, well, we have a few questions for you. Before we wrap, we have, we call it our misfit moment. What was the moment that you knew that the traditional world was not for you?
Sound effects are amazing. Make me feel at home. I'm sorry to say that it was, well, I feel like it's too late in life, but it was, I was probably 27 or so. And I was deep in grad school and I was struggling through my whatever and like totally miserable. And I was just like, I can't do this. I'm not good enough. But I like couldn't allow myself to do anything else. Anything I did, if I went and did a little comedy or circus, I was like failing. I was like, I need to focus. And this is so terrible because of who we now know this person to be. But I read like a New York Magazine profile of James Franco, of all people. This is before we learned he was doing all this horrible stuff. Oh. It was this glowing profile and it was like, wow. What an interesting guy. He's an actor. He's a writer. He's a teacher. He's an artist. He's this. And I remember reading it and being like, oh, if James Franco can do this, like do multiple things, then so can I. And that was the first moment my then boyfriend came home. I was like, guess what? I don't have to choose. I can do all these weird things. And he was like, yeah, duh. And I had been spending my whole life, I mean, still, yeah, it was another 10 years before I like internalized that. But it was the first time that I was like, stop forcing myself. I was like, you don't have to keep trying to force yourself in like the square hole or whatever that analogy is. Like you can just be in all the little pieces. And it wasn't, yeah, I was like super old, super miserable, super old, 27, but like older than like, oh, middle school. I had some reckoning where I was like, I'm special and different. But that was when I was like, oh, what, I can accept who I am and it's okay. Whereas before then I was just trying so hard to fit into a particular mold.
Hell yeah. Yeah. We're going to give that a clap.
I always feel bad at like giving James Franco any kind of credit. I wish it wasn't James Franco, but I...
Oh my God. I reviewed a play of his and it was one of the worst reviews, ooh, I've ever given someone. That play, like my friend, I had an artist friend with me and she was like, this play should be put in a drawer and never unlocked and never seen again. It was so awful. It was very much shady on like reporting rape. And it was awful. And they were like all talking about it glowingly, like, oh yeah, like it should be seen at colleges. No, it shouldn't. And I'm pretty sure it's never was seen again. It was just,
I'm glad it didn't
awful.
Get any traction. But meanwhile, so there's tons and tons of wonderful plays that people are too afraid to take out of the drawer, right? And they're probably incredible.
Yeah. Yes. The James Franco is going to do it. Yeah. So, okay. And then we talk about misfit inspiration, misspiration, if you will. What you go to, quote, podcast, book, example, person, mantra, whatever it is to get you through the lows.
Oh, that's good. That's very helpful. It changes over time, depending on what kind of aspect of my life I'm struggling with, or what kind of low I'm feeling. But generally I go to, I mean, I mentioned Hannah Gatsby. She watching her show was such a revelation, obviously emotionally and meaningful in terms of the substance, but just being like, oh, you can do this with comedy. And seeing the kind of hate she's gotten for it and how she's like continued to persevere. So I am like, you know, Hannah Gatsby is an incredible role model to me. And so I'll think of her. I also think of, there's a handful of fellow former academics turned artists of various kinds who are doing really interesting things. One is, his name is Brian Wecht, and he's at a band called Ninja Sex Party. And he was a theoretical physicist. And then his like improv comedy duo took off. And so he left his physics professor job to do music. And he's been really, really nice to me. And he's like, to me, he represents like, he was the straight and arrow ideal. And he was brave enough to be like, I don't want that. And he's a cishet white man and had like everything going for him. And he was like, no, I want a more interesting life. And so just seeing people, Adam Grant is another friend of mine who talks a lot about the role that being a magician growing up and a diver has played in him thinking the way that he does. I feel like I'm naming a lot of white dudes, which is too bad. But you know, and frankly, and this is the last I'll say on this, is I remember that like all the great minds of the past were multi-talented, and you just don't see us celebrating the Renaissance people like that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'll give that a clown horn. All right. So I have a question from one of my kids. Okay. I'll let you choose. So I have Martha Stewart and Mae Musk and Melania Trump all want to talk to you. I don't know which one do you, Melania Trump, Mae Musk, Elon Musk's mother, or Martha Stewart?
I'd like to talk to Martha. What's Martha up to these days?
Okay. All right. Yeah. Okay. All right. Hi. Nice to see you. I was just pruning my chive bush in the back before I turn butter to make dollop with Chantilly cream for my steaks this evening, which I've gotten from my pasture in the back. We've just butchered a cow today.
That's very nice. Yeah, I had
get all that blood off my sofa. Okay. All right. We brought it in, and there was a spill.
You brought the cow inside.
All right. Well, a severed cow. We butchered it I butchered it myself. I believe in doing all of the hard work. It's, you know, it's part of my brand. The brand is me and I'm the brand.
Martha Stewart Living.
So Martha Stewart Living. All the living. Now, I think it's so interesting you talk about low self-esteem. I don't understand this concept. I hear some people have it where they doubt something they do. It's fascinating. Your brand. What would you say your brand is in the multi-brand universe?
Well, I can tell you what I would like it to be. I don't think it's there yet. But I would like the brand to be a mix. I'm going to feel, I don't normally talk about this. It would be a mix of Stephen Colbert, Taylor Swift, and Bill Nye. And I don't sing, so like the circus version of Taylor Swift, but like someone who talks about science and seemingly unapproachable things in a way that's like inviting and personally resonating with other people and also funny. That's a terrible brand. I need a pithy brand, but that's what I got.
A pithy brand. You want a brand that's less
like a people have like a tagline, right? Like I'm if Spock had a baby with a hunt, and you're like done. Whereas I just listed like a paragraph of things. So I feel like, yeah,
right.
I need a marketeer.
Right. Well, the thing is you have to understand, like my pasture, you know, we grow 50 types of vegetables and 7 types of heritage chickens. Sometimes you need to grow the garden so that you can then cultivate in there and then know what to call it, which for me is just, we decided there are many things that go on, but it's just about Martha.
Yeah. So it's just about Andrea. That's the new brand eventually, but I see we'll go maybe wide before we bring the cow in the house. Yeah.
Well, yes, the cows go, so to speak. The cow come home into your kitchen for the bouillabaisse. All right. Yeah. Well, all right. So great to see you. I look forward to your media empire. It all starts with a international distributed magazine. That's all it takes.
I'll get to work on that. Right. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Okay.
All right. Amazing advice from Martha.
That's Martha. Yeah. Martha's the best because she doesn't doubt herself.
I like it. I love her. I'm going to channel. What would Martha, if I can look up to James Franco, I can look up to Martha Stewart. Like I'm just picking all the wrong people. Look up is not the wrong word.
Martha's
take inspiration
amazing.
From.
Yeah. Her business book is amazing. It's so great. Yeah. It's she wrote it in jail because everyone was asking her for advice and she ended up doing workshops.
Oh my God. I would like to go to jail with Martha Stewart. Can I do that? Is it too late?
Yeah,
for that?
She's the best. Yeah.
Good for her going to jail and coming out and somehow being unscathed as like the happy homemaker party thrower. Like you were in the slammer. What are you doing? We didn't care.
Right. And her whole attitude was like, that was ridiculous. Some people said you can fight it. I thought, let's just get it over with. That's her.
Amazing.
Gangsta. She was like, let's just do it. I'll do the time. I'll write a book, re-update my brand, and
that's
we're
amazing.
Over. Like, she's just so
maybe
gangsta.
I should go to prison to really focus. Here I am, like, messing around with my, like, sabbatical from comedy. And it's like, no, I just need to go to jail. That's what I need to do.
Yeah. That's it.
All right.
Okay, done.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll call in from, we'll do a live show from prison for the next episode.
So where, before you get to jail, where can people catch up with you or to follow your jail journey?
Follow my jail journey on TikTok and Instagram at Jonesroy, JonesRooy. And you can find links to my like longer form, whatever, and YouTube stuff. Also Jonesroy and also Jonesroy.com. And I perform all over New York City and do live stream, blah, blah, blah stuff. But I post about it online. Like everyone. Yeah.
Heck yeah. All right. Well, we look forward to seeing you.
Thanks very much.
Well, there you have it. You can follow the podcast on my page at Lauren Logie. Updates and inside info on my email list, LaurenLogie.com. Thank you to Annie McCutcheon for editing, Edward Silla at Radio Misfits Podcast Network, and Maddie McLennan for making the podcast art. Thanks to our listeners for bringing us back for another season. We'll see you soon.
The preceding was a presentation of the Radio Misfits Podcast Network. Find our other great shows on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and at RadioMisfits.com. Thank you.